for questions. There will be a homework posted a little bit later today. I'm having to add another variable to the data set to have you able to answer one question. It is due on Friday, so a week from this Friday. That is done in recognition of Thanksgiving. I'm only partly that nice. In fact, my wife was pointing out that not only does she have to protect y'all from me, but increasingly she says she has to protect my daughter's class from her. So talk about it, but you know, it's too difficult. But because I do want the statistical analysis plans by Wednesday, then we will hold sessions at 3:30 for the beta carotene and 4:30 for the audiology on Wednesday. I don't have rooms set up where we'll do that, but you'll get an email about that. So because of that, the homework will be due on Friday. Then there will be one more homework after that due the following Friday then. Questions on other topics?
Sorry.
Yes. Pardon? That 3:30 will be beta carotene. 4:30 will be the audiology.
Thanks.
And they will be hopefully in the same room somewhere or another, but I haven't located that room yet. And that will just be an opportunity to talk about some general things about each of those data analyses prior to your writing up. But again, I do want the statistical analysis plans beforehand. That is to say, the major goal of those statistical analysis plans is that you will have thought about it beforehand. You will be allowed, unlike real life, you will be allowed to change your analysis based on what we get out of the discussion, but I want you to have thought about it. Okay. Well, we were talking about the chi-square test, and you know, I showed you this easy computational form for the chi-square test using the familiar representation of A, B, C, and D as the interior cells of this 2x2 table. We had noted that these are asymptotic results. These are results based on approximations that are valid in large sample sizes. The usual definition that is used as a large sample size in this case is that the expected counts would be greater than 5 in the vast majority of the cells. Well, with only 4 cells, so is the vast majority 3? Well, why I said the vast majority of the cells is if you were doing stratified analyses, we don't need it to be bigger than 5 in all of the stratified analyses. It's really in the combination of all of those cells. So the idea would be, if the expected counts for A, B, C, and D were each 5, then that's usually regarded as good enough for the asymptotic results to hold. Those expected values would, of course, be N0 times M0 times N, or similar values for all of them. N0 times M0 over N for the for those expected counts. There are, as we remarked last time, also other large sample tests. The likelihood ratio test is also has a chi-squared distribution in large samples, but it's not the same statistic as what we usually call the chi-squared statistic. It's often the most powerful. It's less commonly used in 2x2 tables, but in logistic regression, it is used. And so it is another form that we would see. Talked about these data commands, CS, which would give you the 2x2 table, talk about the risks at the bottom, and then the difference in proportions would be reported as the risk difference, in this case, the -0.037 with its confidence interval, and then down at the bottom is the two-sided p-value from the chi-square test, which in this case was 0.0679. has the usual interpretation where we're looking at the difference in prevalence, the difference in proportions. And we remarked last time on the fact that the test, the chi-square test, uses a variance estimate that is different from the variance estimate that's usually used when making the confidence intervals. So because of that, it is not uncommon that you will get a p-value that clashes with the, it's not impossible that you will get a p-value that clashes with what the confidence interval is. Our usual practice in those instances is we use the p-value from the test for the testing situation, and we go ahead and report the confidence interval. And as I remarked last time, there are ways that we could use confidence intervals that do better, that would be a score-based confidence interval, but I just don't know of any software that does that automatically for you. And there are some difficulties with that. But given that this is an asymptotic test, and given that we're just comparing the means, it's of interest to say, is this really doing anything different from the t-test? So the party line is, if you had binary data, you should be using the chi-square test. But is that really any different from using the t-test? So here is, if I just put in the exact same variable, so I'm looking at hepatomegaly by the treatment group, I did, this time I used the option that allows for unequal variances, and did my comparison. And you see down at the bottom, the p-value that I got was 0.0682. My confidence interval, negative 0.215 to 0.008. And if we go back to what we had here, my p-value was 0.0679. They differ by 0.0003. And the confidence interval, negative 0.214 to 0.007. Nearly identical to what the p-value was for the t-test. I mean, the confidence interval for the t-test. So really, they are doing the same thing. It's just a matter of habit that we tend to demand that you say the chi-square test rather than the t-test. So from the standard analysis, the confidence interval, negative 0.214 to 0.007. P-value 0.0679 from the non-standard t-test based analysis, we get the same results. So in my ideal world, I would be allowed to stop teaching you the chi-square test and just teach you always to do the t-test no matter what. But I'm not there yet. Historically, a continuity correction to the chi-square test was devised to try to avoid its anti-conservatism in small samples. All that was achieved was getting a test that behaves as poorly as the Fisher's exact test. And so I do not recommend you using the Yates correction. If you're in small samples, I urge you to do other things we'll talk about next. So comparing independent proportions in small samples, again, without censored data. Well, we can't really get the exact distribution in general. Okay, so everything we say about being able to get this exact distribution, the problem that we face is we're interested in knowing whether P1 is equal to P2. But the variance depends upon both P1 and P2. So how many different ways can P1 be equal to P2? Well, they can both be 0.1. They can both be 0.4. They can both be 0.7. They can both be 0.934, right? There's an infinite number of ways that P1 can equal to P2, and there's half that many ways that they can have different variances. So this is the problem that we face. So we can't get exact confidence intervals for the different proportions. We have lots of ways that get us really close. We could consider all possible values of the two proportions and see whether a test would reject each combination. But the resulting joint confidence interval would not always give the same decision for equal differences. So 0.1 and 0.2 have a difference of 0.1. 0.4 and 0.5 have a difference of 0.1. But we wouldn't always get the same results based on those two equal values of what we're trying to estimate, but different settings. We can describe the exact distribution of the data under the null hypothesis that is conditional on the margins of the contingency table. Okay? So this is saying, given that we saw a total of 40 successes, and given that there was a total of 50 people on treatment, now, of all of those situations, what's the probability that there's a difference? And conditioning on that total is unrelated to the differences, and so that's why we're allowed to do this. And this is a permutation distribution. We imagine randomly assigning observations between the groups. So in our 2x2 table where we observed A, B, C, D, and so we observed A plus B is equal to N0, C plus D is equal to N1. Perhaps we set those by our experimental design. But we observe A plus C is equal to M0, B plus D is equal to M1. That was random. We didn't know what was going to happen there. But what we're going to do is we're going to condition on all the times that we see M0 and M1 as the totals, and N0 and N1 as the group totals, how often do we get A or something less than that in that first cell? And this is an okay thing to do because the total of A plus C doesn't give us information about what the difference between A and C is. So this is something that we call an ancillary statistic. It's unrelated to the question we're trying to answer. Now, I usually object to permutation distributions except as a last resort. They test equality of distributions, not just equality of the population parameter. And so when other times that we've looked at, you know, the thing of saying, well, gee, I wanted to really test the difference in the means. I didn't want to test the difference in the variances. And so I wouldn't be happy with something that was testing the equality of the distributions. But with binary data, the distributions are different if and only if the proportions are different. So permutation tests are okay here. I know exactly what the distribution is. But we don't really have good confidence intervals because we haven't quantified our alternatives on this difference in proportions. So the small sample test, we condition on the margin. Often one margin is fixed by design. And then it can be shown that none of the margin totals contribute information about the difference in proportions. And so this is Fisher's exact test. So Fisher's exact test considers all the possible outcomes. Remember, I observed A, B, C, and D, but I consider all the possible outcomes where I might subtract some value from A, and then that will determine what everything else is. So I'll look at the probability of observing A, B, C, D, or A minus K, B plus K, C plus K, and B minus K, and this is not something that you want to do by hand. Okay, this is something that you want to let the computer do, but that's what Fisher's exact test is doing. We can get those Fisher's exact test p-values by several commands, CS and tabulate. If we type the word exact, it will give the one-sided and two-sided p-values. So recall that those give chi-square statistics by default, but you can get the exact test instead. So when I did that with the hepatomegaly by treatment group, and I said exact, everything looks the same. But now I get my one-sided Fisher's exact test p-value of 0.0433 and the two-sided Fisher's exact test p-value of 0.0704. Not really that different from the 0.068 we had observed before. And in large samples, they will tend to agree. And so in large samples, we tend to use the chi-square test. It's easier. But small samples, they won't necessarily agree. And the Fisher's exact test is guaranteed to have a type 1 error less than or equal to the desired 0.05 level. The chi-square test is not guaranteed to do that. Yes?
What if I have a smaller sampling?
It's back to how many events you have. So it's back to that rule of having an expected U of 5 in each cell, that any sample size you name, 6 billion, if it's a rare enough event, I just won't have any information. And that's not a big enough sample size yet. So that's why we count by how many events we have. So Fisher's exact test does not turn out to be an exact test in practice. Okay, so as we actually use it, we are not happy with it. There is a way that you could make an exact test, but nobody will put up with that. The way that you do that is you get some results and then you flip a coin to decide whether you'd reject it or not. And most people don't like that concept of you hire a statistician and they go back in their back room and flip a coin and decide what your p-value is. So to get the desired level of 0.05, we would have to sometimes reject the null hypothesis, for instance, when both groups had zero successes. So we flip a coin in that situation, decide whether it was significant or not, and nobody's willing to do that. Most people are just happy with saying, well, when both groups had zero successes, then we have no evidence to suggest the probability is different. So we face a dilemma. The chi-squared test may be anti-conservative in small samples. Of course, it's that rule that generally we accept it as being okay if the expected counts are greater than 5. But the Fisher's exact test is too conservative. There are alternatives. We can modify either one of those tests to achieve as close to the nominal type 1 error without exceeding it. There are several statistical packages that do these modified tests. StatExact is probably the best known of these. Stata does not. But the basic idea is we still use the statistic, but we don't presume the distribution that was classically determined. So we use the chi-square statistic, but we don't use the chi-square distribution. And we use the Fisher's exact p-value, but we don't pretend that it's really the probability. And then we take all possible values of p. Again, I said, you know, p1 can be equal to p2, and it can be 0.1, or p1 can be equal to 0.2, and it can be 0.3, and so on. I consider every possible one of those values, and then I choose what level will never reject more than 5%. So it's called an unconditional exact test. And here's the problem. So on the left, I show you what the type 1 error of the chi-square test is if I use the critical value from the chi-square distribution, which is 1.96 squared. 1.96 squared is 3.84. So if I computed my chi-square statistic and compared it to 3.84, I was hoping to have a level 0.05 test. But down at the bottom, I plot that P1 is equal to P2 is equal to 0, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5. I didn't need to go higher than 0.5 because it starts looking like a mirror image. And you see that usually the chi-square test has a type 1 error that's less than 0.05, except for when P1 is equal to P2 is between around 0.2 and 0.4 for this sample size. That this is the sample size that I used in this particular case was where there's 15 in each group. Fisher's exact test, on the other hand, I was trying to get a level 0.05 test, and it's never even up to 0.02. It's never up to 0.02. This means that I'm not rejecting type 1 error as often, rejecting my null hypothesis as often as I want. This means I don't have very much power. But I can fix both of those tests. For instance, on the right-hand panel, I say, well, you know what? Instead of using your Fisher's exact test p-value and rejecting when p is less than 0.05, reject when p is less than 0.1086, and then say it's a level 0.05 test. Okay? So I'm using the statistic, I'm just using a different critical value. And you can see that no matter what the value of P1 equaling P2 is, that's always staying below 0.05. The solid line looks at the chi-square test and says, instead of using 3.84, which is 1.96, which comes from the standard normal, use 3.9683. Those numbers are specific to the 15 and 15 sample sizes. Okay? But it's real easy to get a program that you just plug in your sample sizes and it tells you what numbers to use. And so it can do that. If anybody's really interested, I have those programs in R that you can do that. That's what generated this code. But something like StatExact would do that for you as well. Here's the problem. The power of the test, the left-hand panel says, well, if you're using the chi-square test with 3.84 or using the chi-square test with 3.9683, so that dashed line that's just barely below the solid line, that dashed line is the loss of power you get that's due to the chi-square test not being exactly right in small samples. The next panel shows Fisher's exact test. Fisher's exact test using 0.05 has a big loss of power. Looking at power curves, looking at graphs like this, you need to really watch yourself. Our eye has a tendency to look perpendicularly to the curve, but the loss of power is the vertical distance. So we see that on this, if I used the adjusted Fisher's exact test, I would have had 60% power. If I used the unadjusted test, I only had about 40% power. That 20% loss in power is a loss in your ability to find the treatment effect that you want. Okay? Now, this scares me in my life because where people tend to have very low numbers of events, and so they're inclined to say, oh, I can't use the chi-square test, is in toxicity. You know, I have a few patients who have a myocardial infarction taking this drug, or their liver melts, or their brain dribbles out their ear. There's not a whole lot of them, but we want to know, is this really associated with the treatment? If you go and use the Fisher's exact test in those situations and don't adjust it, you're basically giving the drug company a license to kill. You're saying, well, we couldn't find any problem with the toxicity. So this is where it's most important. Carly.
What is power?
Power is the probability that you will reject your null hypothesis. So this is your ability to detect the result. So my general recommendation is, you know, we aren't really going to do any of these unconditional exact tests in here. We usually have sample sizes large enough that the chi-square is perfect. But if you in your own research are dealing with some situation where you know you're going to have very small sample sizes, do not plan your study saying, I'm going to use Fisher's exact test because I have small sample sizes. It is well worth your money to go out and get a program that will do this correctly and use these adjusted tests because that's where you need it most. Carla?
For the chi-square test adjusted, uh-huh. So you lose power when this P2 is, you know, up until like maybe 0.6 and then it's about equal?
Yes.
But you don't, so what you're saying is that with chi-squared, you don't see much of a difference when you adjust versus without
right.
The differences in the Fisher's?
That's right. Okay. That's right. Because the Fisher's exact test is so conservative. Okay. The chi-square test is pretty good. And actually, when you look at this chi-square test, I was confronted with this on a recent clinical trial where somebody said, you're using these methods, and are you really going to have enough events to be able to do this, and can we trust your p-value? Look what happens to the type 1 error when you've got a very, very low event rate. It's way below 0.05. I mean, when you've got a real low event rate, the chi-square test is conservative too. It's just that it's anti-conservative as your event rate gets moderate. And that tends to be true for other sample sizes, too, that are low. The curve looks very similar to this. Sometimes this one, if you did the mirror image, it has two peaks. It looks like an M. Other ones, it'll look like a single peak in the middle. But that's where you get into trouble, not with those real low event rates. So usually the chi-square test works fine. So which one you adjust, I have found that whether you use the Fisher's exact test, the p-value, the chi-square statistic, or I've even got things where I look at using the t-test and adjusting the t-test appropriately in this thing. It generally gives you very similar behavior across all of these. Whichever one you adjust for your small sample sizes does well. But you do have to look at exactly the sample sizes you're using. You'll get substantial improvement in precision and therefore power in low sample size. And when you're confronted with small samples in real life, that's exactly when to do it. You know, that if you really got a question that you need to answer in a very small sample size, you've got to use the best techniques that you have. Now, another way to summarize binary data is with odds ratios. Previously, we were looking at inference based on the probability of exceeding a threshold. Sometimes it's more convenient to discuss the odds of exceeding a threshold. And the odds are just the probability divided by 1 minus the probability. As we've talked about in descriptive statistics, odds are not intuitively understood by many people, except perhaps for those who own the horses an awful lot. Right? So in gambling, we use odds more than probabilities. But otherwise, it's really probabilities we talk about. And this is easily proven by going into a room even full of statisticians and asking them the odds of rolling a 1 when you roll a die, and an amazing number of them answer 1/6, when we all know the answer is 1/5. However, in 1 and 2 sample problems, we can get inference about the odds easily by just doing inference about the probability or the proportion, and that proportion is more easily understood. But why do we use the odds? Well, we can avoid effect modification. When adjusting for confounders or precision variables, it's intuitively unlikely that differences in proportions will be the same across all subgroups. Proportions must be between 0 and 1. And so if you have something that, you know, increases your probability of success by an absolute difference of 20%, well, there has to be effect modification if the baseline rate is 85%. You can't increase it by 20%. So there would have to be effect modification. Odds are between 0 and infinity, and since we actually analyze odds on the log scale, because we look at ratios, so we do it on the log scale, and so log odds can be between negative infinity and infinity, and that tends to make it a little bit more possible that there can be effects without effect modification. And then the other advantage is in case control studies, where the odds ratio can be shown to be estimating the same thing as the probability ratio. So when an outcome event is rare, case control sampling is efficient. Odds are very close to the probability. The probability over 1 minus the probability, well, if the probability is small, 1 minus the probability is approximately 1. And so the odds ratio is approximately the risk ratio. So in this case control study, by estimating the odds ratio and calling it the risk ratio, that's okay, but it better be a rare event.
Why wouldn't you just use the risk ratio?
Well, because the risk that we really want is the opposite risk. So you don't really care about, among those people who have cancer, how many smoked. You really care among those who smoked how many had the got cancer. And so this is the reason that we use this, is that the odds ratio also is estimated the same either way. So the odds ratio is independent of which odds you're talking about. So in cohort studies where we can estimate the probability of disease given exposed, that's what we really want to estimate. That's certainly the more causal question that we have. We think the exposure causes the disease rather than the disease causes the exposure. But case control studies, for efficiency, we sample the diseased and look at the probability of being exposed. The odds ratio for exposure based on disease from the case control study is mathematically equivalent to the odds ratio for disease given exposure. So by looking at that odds ratio in the backwards question, we're equal to the odds ratio in the forward question, and that odds ratio in the forward question is the risk ratio that we really want to test. So for rare disease, this is approximately the ratio of disease probability. In our case control study, the exposures will not be rare in the disease population, right? So cancer is a relatively rare disease. Certainly any particular type of cancer is a rare disease. If you wanted to do a study where you got 100 smokers and 100 non-smokers and followed them until they got cancer, the NIH isn't going to fund that one. Okay. But by taking the smokers and the, taking the cancer patients and the non-cancer patients and asking them about what they happened in the past, you will find a fair number of the people with cancer have smoked. That is not a rare event. But the odds ratio that we calculate there is exactly equal to the odds ratio if we had been able to do the cohort study. And in the cohort study, the cancer is a rare event, so now we're okay. So that's the best justification for using the odds ratio. People use it all the time when it's not a rare event, and then it's more problematic to interpret. So in logistic regression, we analyze the odds ratios, and people do not limit logistic regression just to the case of rare events. Inference about the odds is usually made in the context of the chi-square test, so therefore, as we do difference in proportions, it would be the exact same statistic. We would just report the chi-square test. And in Stata, we obtain estimates of the odds ratio using CC, case control, and it provides odds ratio and the chi-square statistic. So in a 2x2 table, we'll get the exact same chi-square statistic, whether you're talking about a difference in proportions or you're talking about an odds ratio. It's just the estimates and the confidence interval that will differ between CC and CS. I think in two sample tests, using the difference in proportions is best. It's better understood, unless you're in a case control study where we're trying to estimate that relative risk. But when you have multiple samples or you're adjusting for covariates, we tend to use logistic regression, and our summary measures are based on the odds ratio. Questions on these two sample tests of estimating proportions or odds in uncensored data? Okay, well, when we have censored data, we can still be interested in estimating probabilities, but we can't use the same techniques. We just have to use the techniques that we have for write censored data. So we can try to compare independent proportions, so compare proportions for two independent populations, and we will just do that in large samples where we have censored data, and we will use Kaplan-Meier estimates. Then we will introduce hazard functions, looking at hazard ratios and the log rank test, and then we will compare, just mention that you can compare quantiles in parametric accelerated failure time models, but we won't really do that. That might be done in 518. It may not. That's something that just comes in there sometimes. So, from lecture 6, we talked about censored variables, special type of missing data. The exact value is not always known. There can be right censoring, in which case we know that some observations, that the true value of the observation is above some threshold, but all we know is that threshold. There's also left censoring and interval censoring, but we focus on right censoring in this class. So in the PSA data set, subjects were followed with serial measurements of the prostate-specific antigen. We were interested in time to relapse, but at the time that we analyzed the data, some were still in remission. in the university salary data set. Interest is in sex discrimination. We're interested in, do women survive too long as associate professors? You know, or how often do they get promoted? And the trouble is that at the time we analyzed our data, some subjects have not yet been promoted. If we ignore these subjects, we'll be ignoring the effect that we're trying to identify. Sample mean, sample median, other sample quantile, sample standard deviation, sample variance are not appropriate when you have right-centered data. Instead, our descriptive statistics are computed using the Kaplan-Meier estimate. The only exception, and we've done this on several of our data sets, saying, but if the earliest time of censoring is beyond the time that you care about, then we can use binomial proportions. So in the PSA data set, all subjects were followed at least 24 months. In our other data sets from the CHS, one of them, the 4 years was a little bit over 4 years was the minimal censoring time. In the inflammatory data set, I believe it was 5 years. Our estimation methods are only appropriate if the censoring is not informative about subjects who were either more or less likely to have an event in the immediate future. So censored subjects must look like a random sample of those at risk at the time of censoring. Later, if we are comparing groups, we only need them to be representative within their groups that we're comparing. So how do we compare proportions? Well, the Kaplan-Meier estimate estimates the probability that the true event time is greater than C for some arbitrary C. That's a proportion. It's a proportion. This is non-parametric. It's distribution-free. Works for all distributions. And, in fact, it works for uncensored data if you wanted to do it that way. It's consistent for the true value, which means that in infinite sample sizes, you'll estimate the correct value. We can, from that, derive estimates of quantiles. We can only estimate the mean if the estimated survival curve goes to zero, but we sometimes define a restricted mean up to some time. Of those people who I treat for cancer, what's the average number of months they're alive during the first 24 months after treatment? That's a restricted mean. The approximate distribution. If we're interested in theta, which is the probability of surviving beyond time C in the presence of right censoring, the Kaplan-Meier estimate is this product limit estimate that, again, we use a computer to do it for us, and it gets the standard errors, again, from Greenwood's formula. That's there for the words. If you see somebody say, we use Kaplan-Meier with Greenwood's formula, that was the way that they calculated the standard errors. In Stata, we of course set up our survival data using STSET, as we've been doing on several homeworks. We get estimates and plots. We plot the survival curves using STS graph. We list the survival estimates using STS list. We could save those estimates if we desired. And then Stata does not give us an easy comparison of the Kaplan-Meier curves at particular times. We have to do that ourselves. Okay. They do give us the standard errors. So what we have to do is, as we estimate a proportion using the Kaplan-Meier estimate in group 1, that'll be theta 1 hat, or in group 2, that's theta 2 hat, we will have to use Stata's facility for giving us the standard errors in order to find out what the standard error of the difference is. And so we will be focusing on theta 1 hat minus theta 2 hat most often. So we want a difference in survival probabilities between two groups. And what we'll do, we'll take the standard errors for each estimate, square it, add it, and then take the square root of it to get the standard error. If we wanted a relative risk here, we could use this formula. It's not very pretty, and it's not truly as well behaved as some other
estimates, because as a ratio, it would be better for us to do this on a log scale, truly. As with any approximately normally distributed estimator, we take the estimate plus or minus the Z critical value times our standard error. We get our Z statistic by taking our estimate minus our null hypothesis and dividing that by the standard error. So in the PSA data set, we have men with prostate cancer, gave them hormonal treatment, we followed for signs of progression. We're interested in estimating the probability of remaining in remission for 3 years. And we're going to test the hypothesis that the 3-year survival differs between those subjects who have a bone scan score less than three and those who have a bone scan score equal to 3. We read in our data, noting the string variable for the in remission. We generate our relapse indicator, and we set our survival variables, obs time and relapse. We dichotomize bone scan score, and as we've done in dichotomizing data, there's different methods we can use. If we generate our indicator variable, we have to explicitly consider missing data. If we use RECODE, RECODE handles missing data appropriately. And then I ask STS list by bone scan score 3, and I ask for it at 12 months, 24 months, 36 months, and 48 months. Again, there is just this aspect in STATA that it doesn't give you just one. You always have to ask for it at 2 times, or else it doesn't give you what you want. But we can just look at this descriptively, but we're going to focus on the 36-month, the 3-year survival probability, which in the group who have a bone scan score less than 3, so BSS3 is equal to 0, we have a survival probability estimated at 0.713, a standard error of 0.1092, and a confidence interval from 0.4398 to 0.8699. Again, as we saw in the one sample, that confidence interval is calculated by default on the log negative log scale. So it will not be the estimate plus or minus 1.96 times the standard error. There are ways you can get STATA to give you that, but it doesn't in this case. We're going to do testing, and we're going to do differences, and we're going to do it just using the Greenwood's formula standard error as given for 0.1092 in that group. For the bone scan score of 3, so BSS3 equals 1, our estimated survival probability at 3 years, 0.2963, with a standard error of 0.0841. So these 3-year survival probabilities taken right out of that table, the estimated difference in 3-year survival probabilities, just subtract the two. The standard error of the estimated difference, I square 0.1092, I square 0.0841, I add the two numbers, and then I take the square root. Variances add, standard deviations do not. We always have to do our arithmetic on the variable. Our 95% confidence interval, I get the critical value using inverse norm, it's 1.96, and I just take my estimate, 0.4167, minus 1.96 times my standard error of 0.1378. I also do it plus. And so my confidence interval is 0.147 to 0.687. My two-sided p-value, 0.0025, which I calculated using norm prob or norm in later versions of STATA. This was done with an earlier version. And I used the negative in order to get the lower tail.
So you use 0.975 because you're using a
two-sided. That is correct. Yes, 1 minus alpha over 2. Our interpretation, Kaplan-Meier estimate of difference in survival, is that men with a bone scan score less than 3 have an absolute improved 3-year survival of 41.7% relative to BSS3. Working with percentages is always difficult. You know, when you talk about an improvement and then you give a percentage,
when I say it's a 20% improvement in survival, does that mean it goes from 50% to 60% because 20% of 50% is 10%? Or do I mean it goes from 50% to 70% because the difference of those two is 20%? It's always confusing. When I think there's any problem with this, I'll usually give explicitly those differences. I'll say an absolute difference or a relative difference. Sometimes I'll give both just so that they can't get confused. With 95% confidence, such an observation is not consistent with a true absolute improvement, less than 14.7% or greater than 68.7%. And based on the p-value of 0.0025, we reject the null hypothesis of no associates. So bone scan score seems to be associated with survival or in remission. Okay, this is not what we most commonly use when we're comparing censored data. Instead, the log rank test is. But there's many times that the dichotomization matters. So, for instance, in childhood leukemia, that is the most common thing to use because we don't care as much about having kids survive for another year or two. When we have had good success finding treatments that have them survive a long period of time, and that we therefore want to look at those treatments that they survive for 5 years. So with childhood leukemia, it would be far more likely that we would compare the 5-year survival. But with adults, we might look for shorter term effects. We might use a comparison based on hazard functions, the log rank test. So we're interested in a probability that an event will occur in a specified time. Right censored data presents problems because the measurement of events was over varying amounts of time. Is this effect modification by time? Is this confounding by time? Or is this increased precision that we would get if we account for time? And in different problems, it can be any one of these things. But we want to be able to account for the time that matter. We want to use methods that adjust for the time of observation. We can look at Kaplan-Meier estimates at a fixed time period or the log rank and the modified Wilcoxon statistics that average the effects over time and report that average effect. With censored data, we switch to something that we probably never would have used if we didn't have censored data. So we switch to the hazard. But if you recall, the Kaplan-Meier estimate was found by estimating the hazards at any given time. So that, with censored data, we can estimate the hazards, and that's what leads us to do this. So among subjects at risk of an event, what's the probability of having an event in the next instant? The advantage of using this with censored data, we only need to consider the subjects who are currently at risk. We only need to consider whether they have an event right then. And then if we lose track of them, well, then they won't appear in our next stage of analysis. But right now, that's all that we'd have to be concerned with. Estimates of the hazard at each time look somewhat like a binomial proportion. We don't often truly estimate the hazard function over time. Instead, we just compare the hazard functions over time. We estimate a hazard ratio, the relative risk of an event, but it's an instantaneous risk. And then we want to average those estimates of the hazard ratio over all times. Now, we're often interested in comparing groups within strata. To get rid of confounding, well, the comparisons within strata are all similar, but failure to stratify results in a comparison that's misleading due to bias. There are nuances here as we go from analyses means to analyses of nonlinear summary measures. I've certainly been talking about this a lot in discussion sections about how can you diagnose confounding, saying, gee, in linear regression, it's easy, logistic and proportional hazards, it's harder. Interactions, comparisons within strata result in different estimates. We can remove confounding by adjusting for the confounder using a stratified test statistic. Adjustment for a covariate means making comparisons between subjects who have similar levels of that covariate. In the FEV data, in discussion section, we talked about comparing smoking children to non-smokers of the same age and height. And we had really sparse data. We really couldn't. But then we look at those differences for every possible combination of age and height, and we'd average those differences. Adjustment for a covariate does not remove interactions. Interactions means the question has different answers and different strata. Adjustment for the covariate will merely average the effect across strata, usually weighted by the sample size in each strata. So we'll start next time talking about these stratified estimates, because that's what the log range statistic is doing. Is it's going to stratify over the risk sets. Have a good holiday.